From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump was asked on Fox News today for his reaction to the news that special counsel Robert Mueller will testify before two congressional committees, the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, next month.
My reaction is it never ends. We had no obstruction. We had no collusion.
Now, Mueller's investigation found no evidence of criminal conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia. But as we've been hearing today, Democrats have questions about that. And Mueller said he couldn't clear the president of obstruction of justice, leaving the door open for Congress to take that up, which is what will now happen at these hearings on July 17th. Let's bring in NPR's justice correspondent, Ryan Lucas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
So Mueller had said he wanted the written report to speak for itself, but then a subpoena is issued. He agrees to come before Congress. What do you make of that?
Well, there was a very long back and forth between House Democrats and Mueller to make this happen. Mueller, as you said, made clear his reluctance to speak publicly about the investigation, said last month that the report is his testimony. He doesn't want to say anything beyond what's in it, even if he is called to testify. Ultimately, it is these subpoenas from the House Judiciary and the Intelligence Committees that are bringing him up to the Hill. And for Democrats, this is a really big deal. They have been eager to have this big headline-grabbing hearing as they look into the Mueller report and the president's actions. Having Mueller himself testify gives them that hearing, gives them that venue. And they think that the American public may tune in and digest what Mueller has to say in public before the cameras in a way that they perhaps didn't really grab onto what was said in the Mueller report in the written version.
Well, we'll see, because it's in the middle of the summer when many Americans have other things to do. We'll see. But Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep spoke with Adam Schiff, the Democratic chair of the House Intelligence Committee, as we said, one that will question Mueller, about what exactly he wants to ask.
This was a president who, through his campaign, had multiple, over 100 contacts with the Russians, some of which still are inexplicable, that we want to ask him about. We want to ask him about some of the limitations on the investigation, some evidence that he was not able to obtain, text messages and emails that were destroyed.
Hey, Ryan, first, could you put that in context? What text messages and emails?
Well, one example of texts is in part one of the report. There was an exchange. Eric Prince and Steve Bannon had differing accounts of discussions about a meeting that Prince had in the Seychelles with a Russian financier. Prince said he and Bannon had discussed this meeting. Bannon said they did not. The special counsel said that they couldn't clarify by reviewing communications because neither Prince nor Bannon could find any messages on their respective devices, electronic devices, from the period around that meeting, which was raised some eyebrows, but that's one example.
Yeah. Well, and Schiff gave another this morning. He wants to know why President Trump's son getting a message from that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton and they wanted to have a meeting, why that isn't conspiracy, why that isn't, you know, exactly what they were supposed to be investigating. So there's going to be questions about that. Well, Mueller also faced criticism about, you know, he's known as straight-laced and by the book, but will he be criticized for being too nuanced?
I think we're going to have to wait and see what it is Mueller's actually going to say. And it's not entirely clear how forthcoming, how expansive he is going to be. Clearly, from the one public statement that he has made so far about the investigation, he does not intend to really expand upon the information in the report. Now, Democrats have made clear that they want him to go beyond, as Schiff puts it, the four corners of what was in the report. They expect him to talk about a range of topics. One of the things that Schiff said that Democrats are interested in is the question of Trump's finances and how far Mueller's team pulled on that investigative thread. They want to get into questions of inconsistent testimony, questions of perjury, obstruction of justice. But Republicans, you know, they have their own issues that they want to look into. They want to talk to Mueller about how he put his team of investigators together, about the allegations that Republicans have raised of abuse of surveillance powers by the FBI and the Justice Department. So until we actually hear from Mueller and what he has to say, it's really hard to kind of try to parse that right now.
And this all as an election is coming and an impeachment inquiry is being called for. NPR's justice correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to Nashville, which, like many cities, is trying to navigate the world of electric scooters. There are 4,000 of them on the streets there, and the mayor now wants them all gone. after a 26-year-old scooter rider died in Nashville after being hit by a car last month. Nashville Mayor David Brierley joins us now. Mayor Brierley, welcome. And where are you right now on scooters?
Right now, the city of Nashville has an ordinance, a set of regulations that allows them in town. I have had our lawyer draft an amendment to some pending legislation that will ban them effectively in the middle of July. It's an experiment we've had here in Nashville for the last few months. We've ended up with about 4,000 of them on the streets, more than that. And it's just not working here. It's a failed experiment. So first, we're just going to pull them off the streets. And then I think we're willing to have some conversations with the providers and see if there's a way for it to work here in Nashville. But it's going to have to be safe. Got a lot of them being both ridden on the sidewalks and being parked there. And it's just not acceptable to me or I think the city of Nashville for people using a wheelchair or people who might be blind not being able to navigate the sidewalks because scooters are blocking the passageway everywhere. So that's where we are right now, and I think the council's likely to go ahead and comply with my request.
Did you feel the same way before the fatal accident?
I did. The first scooter company came to Nashville and didn't ask for permission. They felt it would be better to ask for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And so we had to send them a cease and desist letter that required us ultimately to go pull them off the streets for them in some instances. Then the council decided they wanted to take this leap and experiment. I encouraged them to be more cautious and threatened to veto it, but there was overwhelming support for it on the council. It just turned out not to work like we thought. Everybody who lives and works downtown, or almost everybody who lives and works downtown, it was fed up with them before we had the tragic accident.
Well, it seems like asking for forgiveness rather than permission is part of the business model of some of these companies, which is to dump the scooters on the streets in various cities, get people hooked on them, and then the people will demand that they have access to the scooters, and then the city will have to listen. Do you think you're going to face any pushback from people who've gotten used to getting around Nashville on these scooters when you take them off the streets?
There'll be some. There will be some. But I anecdotally, as I look at folks who are using them, I think it's fair to say that most people in Nashville who are using them are tourists. There are some people who live in the core who are using them, and we've had docked bikes for some time that some people have been using. So we're very much willing to find a way to incorporate new means of lower impact transit and transportation into Nashville. This one just didn't quite work out. I'm pretty sure I can predict with a lot of confidence it's not the last time we will have somebody develop a technology that is easily scalable, that can, with just the flip of a switch, have a pretty significant impact on cities around the world.
Well, do you think that the reason why that is happening is because public transit has come up short in so many places, that people don't have adequate ways to get from here to there, especially if they don't own a car themselves?
Sure. I think that is part of why we see this actually work for people. Sure. That's why, I mean, we're still open to having a conversation with the companies about some way where it could work in the city of Nashville. We're not saying no, absolutely. We're saying no until we get it worked out. And, you know, Nashville is a city that was built around the car for since the 1920s. And so we have got some work to do to catch up with the transit needs of not just our city but our region. The bikes that we have, the docked bikes, are significantly safer than the scooters in many respects.
Why do you say that?
Well, the scooters have a very small wheel. If you're on the roads and hit a divot or a small pothole, you can easily come over the top of it. They also – one of the things that the technology does, it's got, I assume, some sort of algorithm that sends them back to the place where they were used before. And we're finding that a lot of those places are actually in front of bars. So you're presenting an opportunity for somebody who's maybe their judgment isn't at 100% because they had even just a beer or two. And then you're putting them with an instrumentality that requires you to be really on top of your game to avoid accidents.
So when do you think that the scooters might be able to come back under new guidelines and regulations in Nashville?
So we have hopefully the second meeting in July, the third Tuesday in July, the council will go ahead and terminate the existing program. We have a citizen-led transportation licensing commission, and what I've asked them to do is to take a look at best practices and what the consequences of having the program here were, and to then set out some parameters for requests for proposals where all of the companies around the world could submit proposals to the city, and then we would select a limited number of companies with a limited number of scooters to come back to Nashville. That all probably takes us, 120, 180 days. I would love for it to go more quickly, but that's probably a realistic time frame.
That is David Briley, the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let us know what you think. If your city has electric scooters, do you want them banned or do you think they're working? Weigh in at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
You may not know the name Bobby Cutler, but maybe we all should. A charming Harvard raconteur, lawyer, trusted backroom negotiator, so much so that in the 1950s, President Ike Eisenhower brought Cutler to Washington to reform national security and promptly appointed him the country's very first national security advisor. He was called Ike's mystery man, at his elbow, calling, for instance, for more candor about the dangers of nuclear weapons. The New York Times wrote at the time, "No man, with the possible exception of the president, knows so many of the nation's strategic secrets." But Bobby Cutler also backed Eisenhower's ban on communists and homosexuals in the government. This was during the Red Scare, fear of communists, and the lesser-known Lavender Scare. Senator McCarthy and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover both thought to be secretly gay, ferreting out others who were gay. In fact, Hoover would report his latest suspicions to Bobby Cutler, blissfully unaware that Bobby was gay. So were other men in national security. Skip Coons, a naval intelligence officer who Bobby deeply repressed while in government, fell deeply in love with later. And Skip's friend Stephen Benedict, who held several important security jobs. After both Bobby and Skip died, Stephen inherited Cutler's exquisite diaries, which he gave to reporter Peter Schinkel. Peter is Bobby Cutler's great-nephew. His new book is Ike's Mystery Man, The Secret Lives of Robert Cutler. Peter joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Stephen Benedict joins us from the studios of WGTE in Toledo. Stephen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
You are, I understand, 90-plus years now?
92, a couple weeks ago.
Well, what's it like for you to travel back to this time?
Very challenging to try to make some sense out of things that happened 70 years ago.
Right.
I can't pretend that I've done that.
I mean, it's astonishing to read it now, but how secretive and afraid you all had to be.
Yeah, but this wasn't something that occupied us 24/7. You develop a certain crust that protects you against over-worrying a situation that you really can't do anything about once you're in it.
Peter, your exploration started when your mom and aunt sat you down, I think it was as recently as 2006.
That's correct.
And told you that Uncle Bobby, beloved, exciting Uncle Bobby, was gay. I mean, are you thinking, wait, gay and first national security advisor? That does not go together.
That's right. And very close friend of Ike's when homosexuality was so severely persecuted.
And let's be clear about this. When it came to the federal government, of the people who were outed and hunted down and fired, 90% of them were not communists. They were gay or lesbian.
That's right. The numbers of gays would be reported, and those numbers would be used to justify greater Red Scare?
It really goes back to 1947, and that is when the Lavender Scare, so-called, really began to get ahead of steam, and partly because it was associated with the whole Elger Hiss Whitaker Chambers affair.
This is Chambers, the former communist spy who accused Hiss of being a communist, and then papers turned up showing that Chambers had had homosexual encounters before becoming a Christian conservative.
Which helped to combine these two issues of communism and homosexuality. Almost a complete myth. There's almost no truth whatsoever to the proposition that homosexuality predisposes anyone to either communism or to being blackmailed.
Hmm. But, Peter, talk about Bobby Cutler's role as national security advisor, called an honest broker.
He would enable each of these agencies to have their say. Ike had very vigorous debates. Cutler's successors were more proponents or advocates for this or that policy.
Yeah. The New York Times at the time, as I said, raved about him, a proper Bostonian, an earnest Episcopalian. Finally, Mr. Cutler is a bachelor's bachelor. This is the Times writing. He enjoyed himself among the girls and loved women all his life, but no women, however charming, could completely capture his mind and imagination. Did people not know?
It was not a question of being able to find liaisons that would cause one to say he was an active homosexual. He was not.
Bobby Cutler's life struggle to understand his sexual orientation played out through these very trying years in the crucible of the National Security Council. I think his final understanding that he loved this young man, Skip Coons, with all his heart came as late as 1957.
After they'd worked together, I mean, for many years.
Correct. It's actually all the sadder because it is in many ways an unrequited love.
Yeah. Well, but then we have Eisenhower. In the military, he was asked to drum up a list of people suspected to be gay or lesbian. And I love the passage. You write one of his assistants, a woman, says, well, I'll write up the list for you, but I'm going to be the number one on the list. And another woman said, and I'm going to be number two. And he just said, oh, there's so many people in my military who are gay and lesbian. What do I care? But then as president, he goes on to sign Executive Order 10450, which requires every federal agency to investigate both new hires and existing workers to find any connections to communism, but also criminal behavior, drug addiction, sexual perversion, and that was homosexuality.
Eisenhower did sign that order, but it had already been substantially developed by President Truman's Attorney General.
Well, but it led to something called the Miscellaneous M Unit in the State Department. They reported in 1953 that 99 employees had left. No one fired for homosexuality was ever found to have compromised national security in any way. And it led to suicides. And Peter, you quote security agent Peter Zluck, who said, what do I care about due process? If the son of a bee is queer, out he goes. And then a little later, he said he felt a little bad about the suicides. One guy, he barely left my office, and he must have had this thing in his coat pocket, and boom, right on the corner of 21st and Virginia. I mean, you remind us that there was a lawmaker who committed suicide after it was threatened that his child, his son, would be outed. This was a terrible time.
Yeah, and that would be Senator Lester Hunt and his son.
Yeah.
This whole miasma of apprehension was something that was very much in the air at the time.
Well, in fact, Stephen, you were ultimately questioned, and you lied.
Well, I lied many times, of course. That was something one did almost like it came as natural as drinking a glass of water because you knew the atmosphere was such that you would never even be considered for a job were you to come out yourself. When, toward the end of our times in government, because of some other people who had broken, shall we say, we were in fact ourselves questioned and looked at, but also cleared.
Steve, I think you were cleared because Skip resigned.
But he wasn't judged to have violated anything in the security regulations.
It just, Peter, as you learned more about this, how were you taking that in?
The entire process was a 12-year journey for me, learning not only about my great-uncle's life, but also the experience of gay Americans. Mm. Executive Order 10450 identified and targeted a vulnerable minority to point to this minority as causing lots of societal ills. It's an incredible example of what can happen. People who have political power begin blaming our problems on a minority. Cutler did not have to bring forward the order that had been drafted under President Truman that contained the ban on sexual perversion. There had been another tightening of security rules that was proposed. And Cutler said, Mr. President, you should really go back and reconsider this other order. And this is probably owing to Bobby's sense of procedural government. But the fact was that it was Bobby who went back and brought forward this order. And my feeling is that Ike may well have understood that his top national security aide, Robert Cutler, was gay.
If he knew it, he loved Bobby Cutler. Why would he sign that executive order?
I think he had such faith that Bobby Cutler would never get in trouble and would never jeopardize his presidency.
Was it a failure of your uncle's to not take that moment and stand up and say, well, then you're going to have to ban me too? You're nodding.
I believe so, in all honesty. I know Steve objects to this, but in fact, what's fascinating about the debate over Executive Order 10450 is that there's virtually no record of anybody questioning the inclusion of the ban on sexual perversion.
I don't think that Bobby Cutler or anyone could have done anything to reverse a set of policies. It was inconceivable that in those days anyone could have suddenly taken a contrary position with respect to this whole issue.
Look, Stephen Benedict, on this week, also as we recognize the Stonewall riots, when people said, I've had enough. Those men that had that uprising, it's just like 10 years after your silent, secret life in Washington.
Well, it was certainly a very important event. As far as I'm concerned, looking back 70 years, the most extraordinary thing is how far we've come. Certainly not as far as we should, but in those days to have conceived of gay marriage, for example, or someone running for the presidency who was openly gay and married would have been utterly inconceivable.
Hmm. Yeah. That's Stephen Benedict, who worked in the Eisenhower administration. We also spoke with author Peter Schinkel, whose new book about his uncle is Ike's Mystery Man, The Secret Lives of Robert Cutler, a gay man who was the country's first national security advisor. The first Democratic presidential primary debate ahead of the 2020 elections is tonight. There are 20 people who have qualified for two debates tonight and tomorrow night, split because there's just so many of them. Joining us for a preview is NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Robin.
So we could list all of the candidates and then we'll run out of time. So let's just say, you know, part one tonight, this is on live on NBC, held in Miami. There was some initial upset about how the candidates were split up, but it seems as if everything settled down.
I mean, more or less. And some of that upset is, you know, a lot among the Twitter pundits and so on. So I don't know how much your average voter was upset. But yeah, like you said, 20 candidates qualified. And the way it was split up was they took the top polling candidates in this field, which is a relative term with so many people, and they split the top candidates up randomly across the two nights, and then they split the lower polling candidates up across two nights. So, yeah, you have 10 and 10. And as we're going to see tonight, 10 is still a lot of people to have on a debate stage. So people really are going to be squished for time.
Well, we got a preview of this in 2016 when the Republicans did this, when they had so many candidates. But tonight you've got Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren center stage. A lot of her supporters feel that she should have had a chance to go up against Joe Biden. He's tomorrow night. She's really getting known for her policies. They come one after another. But, you know, what's the opportunity or challenge for her?
Sure. So the opportunity is, in a certain sense, the same as everyone else up there on the stage, is that for a lot of Americans, since we're not quite a year and a half out, this is the first time they're going to be hearing from her, maybe even hearing of her, depending on the person. Mm-hmm. So she has this first impression opportunity. And, you know, I've seen her out on the trail, and people at these events, often even undecided voters, really have responded well to her at some of these. So the question is how much that translates over TV. Yeah. And aside from that, she is quite good at explaining her policies to people. So once again, does she keep that alive tonight? And does she explain some of her policies, her wealth tax, that sort of thing, breaking up big tech to people?
Yeah.
But then again, she has, you know, a couple of things she could get stung on. One is, you know, the biggest gaffe that comes to mind, which is those instances in the past where she had identified as Native American, and, you know, Donald Trump has gone after her quite notably for that. And a lot of pundits have asked her about that. So the question is, does she get asked about that again tonight?
Right.
Aside from that, she will have 9 other candidates fighting for screen time, fighting for their big moment. And so I don't know what their plans might be. It's possible they'll come after her, or it's possible they'll just be really aggressive in trying to fight for their own oxygen.
And again, she'll be the only candidate polling in the top 5 on the stage. Let's just go ahead and do it. It'll be Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Bill de Blasio, John Delaney, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Tim Ryan, and Elizabeth Warren. That's just tonight. What are you looking for?
I mean, the big thing is how much do the candidates criticize Trump versus how much do they criticize each other? For a lot of these being Democrats, Trump being supremely unpopular among the Democratic electorate, it would be easy for these candidates to just say, I dislike Trump's policies. What's more difficult is for the candidates who differ on, say, health care. Do you support Medicare for all, or do you support a public option or something else? Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm hoping for tonight is that these differences really come out and the candidates really get into that kind of substance. Aside from that, issues like climate change, immigration, of course, with some of these troubling stories from these detention facilities. You can imagine that will come up as well.
Right. They've been fighting over a bill. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, thanks so much.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
John Moses is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California, and joins us now. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And this is not just your first time on the DJ Sessions. You've only been at KCRW for a few months.
Yes, I am new to the lineup, but have been having a blast. It's really amazing to be part of such a great lineup of DJs.
In the late night in Los Angeles.
That's right, yeah. So I have to adjust my sleeping schedule, but if that's the worst of it, that's fine with me.
And where were you before?
Well, I am originally from Vermont, so I spent a lot of time on a local Burlington, Vermont station, WRUV, and then came out to LA, put my time in, and here we are.
Okay, well, let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is called Cat Call. It's by Former Boy. Started us off by putting us in a very chill LA mood here. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, well, with my time slot late at night, that's usually the vibe. But so, Former Boy is the newest musical project of an LA local, Michael Lundy. He's previously recorded electronic music in the early 2010s, or I guess in sort of the throes of the LA beat scene, or when hip-hop ideals were colliding with electronic
But you wouldn't consider this electronic.
No, and so this project and this album in particular, Talking Treasure, which he self-released on his label Rap Vacation, sort of takes a left turn into psychedelic territory. I guess I would describe it as being more bedroom pop or indie rock mix, but also it does have sort of those electronic elements where it samples loops and also incorporates a lot of local acts. You have producer Swarvy, who works with a lot of people here in LA. You have one of my favorite local rappers, Zero, and an Oakland-based vocalist who just signed to Flying Lotus's Brain Feeder label, Salami Rose Joe Lewis, who's also one of my favorite names to say on air.
It's a good name to say on air. The next one that you have brought us is called This Time Around. This is by Jessica Pratt.
This time around has it gone so crazy that my feet got hollowed. Haven't you heard there's a summer wind gets my head in the wind? All I need, I need magic on your claim and too high, too high. On a face where they're lost and strange, it's too hard to find out. Ah, 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 ah.
This one's very dreamy.
Yeah, absolutely. That is Jessica Pratt's brand. She is an LA-based folk musician. This is her, I guess, from her third album, Quiet Signs, that came out earlier this year in February. And it's the first record where she recorded in a proper sound studio. Her first two records were recorded at home or at friend studios, and were sort of defined by having a raw DIY intimate quality to them. And just from reading interviews, it seemed like she was really worried about losing that aspect of her music by going to a recording studio. But I think, if anything, it's only elevated the subtleties of her music that make her so great.
Interesting. Okay, the next one. Now, this one people will recognize just the sound of it. I don't even know if I have to say the name, but I will say the name, which is Sound of Music. This is by Laibach. Okay, so if people's minds are not blown enough just by listening to this version of what Julie Andrews made so famous, they would also have their minds blown to know that Laibach performed this in North Korea because this film is so well known there because it's used to teach school children English.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack with this record. Laibach is an industrials or neoclassical group from Slovenia, so not the first band or artist you would think that would be invited to North Korea
right,
to perform the very first rock concert by a foreign band ever there. But this album came out late last year. It's equal parts hilarious, but also really conceptually amazing and mind-blowing, and sonically just an incredible record. It features guest vocals from Boris Benko, who performs in the Slovenian band Silence, as well as a Swedish singer, Marina Martinson, and they apply this soaring sort of elegance to the whole album, but it's also matched with the vocals of Laibach's lead singer, Milan Frost, who's very guttural and throaty, almost like a Transylvanian bullfrog. So the combination of those two vocals is really bizarre, but it creates just a really powerful product.
To see
with the sound of music
through the night.
like a lark was learning to pray.
Okay, the last one we have time for today is Hot Cheetos. This is by Mono Neon. In this is, let's take a long walk in your favorite ghetto, go to the corner store and get some hot Cheetos.
Yes. I think this song comes from an album called My Feelings Be Peeling. It's his latest full length, and what he's written, or his artist statement about the album, suggests that even though he might not be able to say everything he wants to your face or in person, often he's able to say that musically. And I think at the very root of this song, it's just a sweet love song. He wants to take you to the corner store and get you some hot Cheetos, which who wouldn't want that? But
I don't know if I've had hot Cheetos. I guess that's a different kind of Cheetos. I've had regular Cheetos.
Well, imagine regular Cheetos, but just spicier.
Okay.
Perfect day snack.
That is John Moses, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. John, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
And we've got all of John's picks and more at our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The GRE, short for Graduate Records Exam, has for decades loomed large over grad students trying for master's and doctoral degrees. The standardized test was required for studies like philosophy, chemistry, literature, medicine. But in recent years, more grad admissions offices have been making the test optional or ignoring it altogether. Jad Slayman of WHYY's The Pulse looked into why.
Joshua Hall had his sights set on a doctoral microbiology program. He'd taken and retaken his GRE practice tests in the dorms. On the big day, he was ready.
So I sat down, I began my test, and I remember at that time there was a section called the analytical section, and this was actually the section that I tended to do the best on.
Enter a villain, the woman sitting next to him.
She was super loud, like she was crumbling some papers up and was just trying to get situated. And it was so distracting. And the more distracted I got, the more nervous I became. I remember sweating, thinking, oh my gosh, I need to do well on this.
He did not. He bombed hard. He had to take the test again, but he did get into grad school. That was some 20 years ago. Hall went on to become Director of Graduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine. And maybe his own experience with the GRE made him a little suspicious, but he noticed something. Evaluating all of these students, seeing their GRE scores, then watching their progress.
There didn't seem to be a correlation between the students who had the highest aptitude in the lab and the students who were getting the best GRE scores. So, you know, I'm a researcher by training. I'm a scientist.
He did some science. He compared GRE scores and student performance, then brought his results to the admissions faculty in 2017.
It really was, in some ways, like going up against a firing squad. It was like, wait, what do you mean the GRE isn't useful? How could it not be useful? We've been using it for all this time.
He demonstrated that the GRE isn't all that great at predicting who succeeds in grad school. And studies at other institutions show the test isn't a very good predictor of who actually finishes a graduate program.
But I can say, you know, the individuals involved in admissions committees for science programs are scientists themselves.
Which is to say, they couldn't ignore the research. UNC's medical school made the GRE optional this year. Hall ended up compiling a list of other schools that don't require the test, and he shared it on social media.
And it really just took off from there.
It was 10 schools last year. Today, it's more than 130. And that's just in the biomedical field.
We've seen first a trickle and then a surge of individual graduate departments determining that the GRE was not a good tool to select entering grad school applicants.
That's Bob Schaefer with the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. He's a sworn enemy of basically every standardized test, including the GRE. To Schaefer, the real harm of the test isn't that it's a bad predictor of student success. It's that it seems to favor whiter, wealthier students. Minorities and poorer students tend to do worse on the test. The GRE people are aware of this. I talked to David Payne, VP of Global Education at Educational Testing Service, the company that makes the test.
Privileged students that come from high-income neighborhoods, those students, on average, are going to have a better educational experience than students who come from areas with less access to resources.
Payne says, actually, the test is supposed to level the playing field. Richer, whiter students have a better chance of getting into grad school because they tend to come from more prestigious undergrad programs. And he says rampant grade inflation at these places compounds their advantage.
So if you're an underrepresented minority starting at a non-selective public university, you've got two strikes against you when you're applying to a selected PhD program.
The idea is an underrepresented student can study hard and bootstrap up from some lackluster state school and into a top grad program on the strength of a high GRE score. But a whole industry has sprung up around the test, prepping students on the questions, teaching strategies to be faster, score higher. Courses can run thousands of dollars. There's plenty of free test prep material out there too, but all this might not matter sooner rather than later as more schools go test optional. Emory University's chemistry department won't even accept test results. Simon Blakely, director of graduate studies, explains why.
Just having those numbers there, it impacts human decision-making. You can't ignore the numbers.
They won't so much as look at your GRE scores. Instead, they look for GRIT, for grit.
When letters of recommendation describe very specific accomplishments and evidence that they've overcome challenges, that they're resilient.
Emory is a private university, very selective. Blakely says the GRE's biases, favoring the richer, the whiter, that narrows the talent pool. The university could miss out on the very best applicants.
People's life experiences will lead them to think about problems differently, and they will lead them to think about different things as being problems.
More diverse people with PhDs and master's degrees, he says, means richer, more diverse academic inquiry. And for students looking at grad programs, more schools opting out of the GRE means one less standardized test to pay for and stress out over. For Here and Now, I'm Jad Slaman.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.